You're listening to Insight here on CAP Radio. I'm your host, Randall White. Vicky Gonzalez is working on a special project today. As we get closer to the midterms in November, our mailboxes will be stuffed with, of course, election flyers. Campaign ads will bombard commercial television, and those text messages from unfamiliar numbers will start asking us to vote yes or no on ballot measures. Our fast-growing sphere of political ad spending, though, is online. According to one analysis, nearly $435 million was spent on digital ads in the 2020 presidential election, making up almost a quarter of total ad spending nationally. In California, the state's campaign finance watchdog agency is pushing for the creation of an online digital archive for these ads. That agency is California's Fair Political Practices Commission, which goes by the initials FPPC. You know, in California government, everything has to go by initials, right? And leaders there say the archive will allow voters to easily find who's behind and financing each ad that pops up on your laptop or smartphone. The commission also made headlines throughout the country this summer when they voted to allow Bitcoin and other cryptocurrencies to be used for political contributions. Well, joining us now to discuss all of this and share how they're preparing for the upcoming midterms is Richard Matich, chair of California's Fair Political Practices Commission. Chairman Matich, welcome to Insight.
Thank you. Good morning.
So I bet you love to geek out on politics and these sorts of things. So it's kind of fun to dive into this with you.
Yes. Thanks for having me. You're right. I do. I love it.
So for our listeners who may be unfamiliar, can you explain some of, you know, the key jobs that your commission takes on in California?
Sure. So the Fair Political Practices Commission is an independent executive branch state agency, and we enforce, administer, and interpret the Political Reform Act of 1974. And the Political Reform Act, or the PRA, because we do love acronyms, is a Watergate era set of laws that require disclosure of spending in our state and local elections.
Yeah, so that's nearly 50 years ago. Are there provisions of this law, since you deal with it constantly as part of your job, that you believe should be changed to adapt to the digital age?
Yeah, that's actually a priority for us at the commission, modernizing the act, both through amendments to the act itself and through our regulations, to both improve transparency for the benefit of the public and efficiency in how things are filed. And so in terms of efficiency, you know, one of the things that we've been doing is trying to allow campaigns to utilize digital signatures as opposed to paper wet signatures that have been required for many, many years to reflect that more transactions are occurring online. And there's no reason we can't do that. And then secondly, allowing campaigns to actually file their reports electronically, as opposed to printing out hundreds and hundreds of pages each and sending those over to the Secretary of State's office for filing. So we're trying to improve efficiency that way. In terms of transparency, though, that's really our main focus, and there are several areas. One of the main areas is election activity over social media platforms. And there's different varieties of that we've tried to address. A couple months ago, we had some regulations that tightened up how paid influencers online have to disclose that they're actually being paid. You know, prior to us taking that action, you may scroll through your social media feed and somebody says something very positive or perhaps negative about a particular candidate, and you wouldn't know that that person was actually being paid to say those things. So we tightened up our regulations to improve transparency around that type of activity.
Richard, how do you stay on top of all of that when there's so many influencers on so many different platforms? Somebody says they like or dislike a candidate or a proposition or that sort of thing. How do you even find that?
Yeah, that's a great question. And so we have a great staff in our enforcement department that takes proactive steps to try and make sure that that type of activity is being transparent in the way that the law requires. We also, you know, every election cycle, we have what we call AdWatch. which is an easy way for the public to submit a complaint or a question about something they may have seen. And then our staff can pick it up from there and investigate and determine whether there's a violation or not. So it's really a partnership between our office and the public for the most part.
We talked about that spending leading into this, about $500 million, just under $500 million back in 2020. Each year, are you seeing those numbers rise when it comes to spending on the social media platforms and other digital outlets?
Absolutely. And it's that really exponential growth. I mean, I think if you look back at like as early as 2010, you were talking, you know, maybe $100,000, a couple $100,000. And now, as you point out, we're approaching, you know, $500 million in digital campaign activity. And so that's really what led us to proactively put together the Digital Transparency Task Force. We brought together academics, campaign professionals, representatives from social media companies, and also good government groups, to sort of put collaboratively our minds together and try to figure out what are some best practices and new approaches to really adapt these Watergate area laws to the reality of current campaign practices, particularly on social media.
And with these influencers, how exactly would they have to say that they're being paid? Would it be in the same vein as when an ad runs for a candidate and then at the end you hear the candidate say, "I'm so-and-so and I approve this message"?
Similar, it would be visual in terms of social media activity, though, if you see it like through your Instagram feed, et cetera. And then there's another piece of this as well, where the campaigns, if they're paying somebody, and this is true whether you're paying a printer, whether you're paying, you know, an influencer, you have to report those expenditures on your campaign finance reports, which are then publicly available for inspection. And so we tightened up the level of detail that the campaigns would have to include in those reports. So you could see who are they paying and where did that type of activity run.
And would a push by a social media or an influencer be among the different advertisements that would end up in this depository of political ads that you're pushing for?
We certainly hope so. I mean, that would be the idea. I mean, the basic concept is we want, you know, one place that the public can easily access to see who is it that is trying to influence your vote through social media and other forms of digital advertisements. We think that's really important for transparency. And frankly, in an age of, you know, we all know there's misinformation out there, it's an accountability tool. This is a way that the public can see what a candidate or a committee has said and then hold them accountable if that, in fact, is not accurate information.
Because it can get really confusing when you see an ad and then it says, you know, this was paid for by a committee for an absolutely beautiful world. And I apologize if that's an actual name of a committee, but but you don't really know who those people are. Would your agency or your commission help you put the dots together to find out who that is?
Yes. And that's exactly what we would hope to envision with the archive is you would go and you'd be able to view the advertisement that ran, and then you'd be able to directly link to the campaign information about the committee that paid for that digital advertisement. And then you'd be able to search and see who their top contributors were, et cetera. So you could follow really the chain of campaign finance to the speech that's actually appearing in your social media feed.
Okay. Are you ready to talk cryptocurrency?
I love talking cryptocurrency.
As you know, the commission, your commission, made headlines around California and the nation when you decided to lift a ban on using cryptocurrency for political donations. What were the conversations that you and other members of the commission were having that ultimately led to this decision?
Well, I would say, you know, from a very big picture level, this is just another iteration of modernizing our approach to campaign finance. You know, several years ago, when a prior version of the commission decided to ban crypto contributions outright, they did so because at that time, it was still kind of an unknown, right? We weren't sure how to approach that. And I think at that time, that was the right approach. What we've seen in the subsequent years is more and more interest in people using digital coins to express themselves, right? And we see other states that have taken a more permissive approach, and it's worked. There haven't been huge problems there. And so as regulators, our primary concern is making sure people can't get around contribution limits and making sure they can't shield the identity of the donors. And so we sat down, we surveyed what other states were doing, and we struck what we think is the appropriate balance between allowing some crypto contributions and also preserving our contribution limits and our donor disclosure laws.
So the big issue, I think, for most critics of this would be the downside when it comes to a lack of transparency, that tracing and knowing who's ultimately behind the donation is more difficult with cryptocurrency. Would you say that's true?
I think it can be. I think that's certainly true. But that's why, as part of our regulations, we did something that's pretty unique. And that is, we require, if you want to use a digital coin to express yourselves in support of a candidate or a campaign, you have to actually utilize a US-based third-party exchange that has robust Know Your Customer protocols. And so, in other words, you're going to have to disclose all the information that you have as a donor so that we can trace who it is ultimately that's making that contribution to the campaign. And it was important that these were US-based exchanges, because this then allows us to go in and, if we want to investigate, we can subpoena the records more easily. So we really gave a lot of thought to looking down the line, you know, how are we going to enforce this? How are we going to ensure compliance? And so that's where we ended up. Know Your Customer protocols and a US-based exchange has to be part of the equation.
What's the main criticism that you're hearing at the commission when people contact you to say, hey, I heard that you made this move, I'm very concerned about XYZ? What are you hearing? What's the XYZ?
So one of the big concerns that we've heard is people are concerned that a campaign may utilize cryptocurrency as a speculative venture, mm-hmm. right? So they receive a crypto coin, and let's say it's worth $100. At the time, but you know, some very prominent person says something on Twitter the next day, and suddenly that's worth $10 million, and the campaign gets the benefit of that, and that completely eviscerates the campaign contribution limits. So we thought about that, and we made sure that can't happen under our approach. You need to immediately convert the crypto to US dollars at the time you contributed. And it has to be below or at the applicable contribution limit. So that hypothetical I just described can never happen under our regulations. So that was a concern, but we certainly addressed that through our regulations.
A few years ago, just pre-pandemic, I guess, the FPPC commissioned a digital transparency task force. Why was this task force created, and what's been achieved so far?
So the task force really was created because we saw the exponential growth in social media, political advertising, and other forms of digital political advertising. And we were mindful of the fact that the Political Reform Act of 1974, you know, again, was sort of based in campaign tactics that existed during the Watergate era. And people don't utilize lawn signs and leaflets like they used to. It's now on these various digital platforms. And so we needed to get a large group together, we thought, harness everybody's expertise and come up with some new approaches to that. And so that's what we did through our recommendations of the task force.
And two of the huge digital platforms that you mentioned include Google and Facebook. The task force did present a report to the commission last year talking about Google and Facebook. What can you tell us about what was heard there, those presentations, and what role do you believe tech companies have when it comes to digital campaign ads on those platforms?
Yeah. So I think tech platforms, social media platforms, they certainly, I think they see it from a commercial standpoint. They're just like a printer, right? Campaigns know that they can utilize these methods to reach voters. And so that's what they're doing. The social media platforms see that as a commercial opportunity. I think where we come in as regulators is ensuring that that activity is fully transparent and reported to the public. So the public understands that if you see something on your social media feed, who is it that's paying for that, and what are their sources of money? And so really the idea of a state-run digital archive, which, by the way, some cities like the city of Los Angeles, the city of New York, they do this for their local elections. So we're not breaking new ground here. This is a tool that's been in existence before. We think it's important to do that at the state level, though, so that we're not totally dependent on the social media platforms to maintain that information for public inspection going forward. We think that's for record retention purposes, for the integrity of the records. We think it's important that the state take a leading role in that effort.
You're listening to Insight here on CAP Radio. And if you're just joining us, we're speaking with Richard Matich. He's the chair of California's Fair Political Practices Commission, or FPPC, about steps they're taking ahead of the midterm elections to help modernize all of this. And as you've mentioned, you're sponsoring a number of bills in this current session. One of those, SB 291, this is the political ad archive that you've mentioned. What's the current status of that bill? We're getting pretty close to the end of the session.
Yeah, unfortunately, like many bills, that was held up in the suspense, the Appropriations Committee. But look, I mean, that's common. This was the first year we introduced that bill. We knew there were things that we need to refine with that bill. And so we're committed to continuing to work on that bill with, you know, our friends over in the legislature and try to get that put into law here pretty soon.
Was it the same fate for AB 775 that takes on campaign financing?
No, that's a success story this year. It's actually a good example. That was a 2-year bill. So that was another one where we knew that this practice was something we needed to address, but it took some time to refine it. And, you know, Assembly Bill 775, and I want to thank Assemblymember Berman for carrying that bill. You know, that's an important bill, or an important bill to be passed. And so what that does is that's going to prevent campaigns from automatically opting in contributors to ongoing political contributions. And this is a problem that we had seen, you know, a little bit here in California. We'd seen it as a problem nationally as well, where people didn't realize that, you know, that $25 contribution they made because they really wanted to support a candidate suddenly turned into a $500 contribution because they were opted in. And every month suddenly their card was being charged for another $25. So this is something where going forward, if this is signed into law, campaigns are going to have to advise contributors that they need to affirmatively consent to that type of a tactic and then provide clear information on how they opt out if they don't wish to have that ongoing contribution.
And has this been signed by the governor?
No, this is still working through the legislature, though. It was recently amended. The commission is fully supportive of it, and we certainly have high hopes that this will get past the finish line this year.
I think everyone can relate to that, whether they've donated to a campaign or not. You get those, a free month of a certain service, but you have to enter your credit card information, and then the month expires, you forget, and the next thing you know, you're being charged for that service. So along those same lines. Last week, you penned an op-ed calling for an end to what you called a deceitful campaign fundraising tactic. Is it this one?
Yes, it is. Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's exactly right.
Yeah. So the FPPC reopened its phone advice lines in July, which were previously suspended because of the pandemic, as so many things were. You said that this type of service is needed to ensure a smooth election. Give us a glimpse of these advice lines, how they work and who should use them.
Yeah, so anyone with obligations under the Political Reform Act, and it's not an exaggeration to say that's, you know, tens of thousands of candidates or public officials or treasurers for these various committees that have questions about their obligations under the Act, how to report something, where to file it, when to file it. That's the type of question that you can get answered easily, quickly through our phone line. We also have an email advice line. And really, this is part of our effort to really build out and make stronger our education and outreach unit. We, you know, particularly, I think about first-time candidates, people who are, you know, interested in getting into the political process, and these rules are complicated, and we don't want it to be a barrier to entry. We want a rich diversity of voices in our political process, and so one way we can help with that is by making it easier to understand the rules, and so this is really part of our effort to do that.
Now, you have said that you want the FPPC to be more of a help you agency than a gotcha agency. Explain that.
Yeah, so that's exactly right. I do not want a first-time candidate who's interested in getting their voice heard to show up before our agency the first time in an enforcement action because they made, you know, an inadvertent mistake in filling something out on one of their reports. I want them to understand that, look, in that sense, we are here to help you understand and comply with the law. I think that's helpful because it's going to drive up compliance. It's going to keep people interested, engaging in the political process. And it's also going to allow us to really direct our, you know, we're a small agency, so we only have so many resources in enforcement. It allows us to target those resources more precisely towards the highest public harm cases, you know, intentional conduct, misuse of campaign funds for personal benefit, you know, using public funds for political purposes that shouldn't be done by local agencies. Those are the things we want to focus on, not these, you know, minor inadvertent errors by first-time candidates. So that's really the big picture that we're thinking of with that.
Chair Matic, your watchdog agency came under scrutiny last fall after an LA Times report revealed that a campaign finance investigation against an FPPC commissioner sat in limbo and out of the public eye for months. What steps have been taken since then to better ensure that the commission holds itself, you know, to the same standards that it holds campaigns and candidates to throughout California?
Yeah, that's critical. You know, we like to say here that, you know, our obligations, we aspire not to the floor. We really see ourselves, we need to be above reproach here. And so in that particular instance, you know, and this was acknowledged in the LA Times article, we actually immediately initiated contact with the Attorney General's office to have it sent over there. Unfortunately, this was the first time that we had to deal with that situation. And so the communication between our agencies took some time to sort out. How do we send it over to you? But I want to be very clear for the public, we took no action on that matter, and we immediately knew we had to send that over to the Attorney General's office. And this year, to make sure that that process is smoother in the future, we recently adopted a regulation that makes it very clear that you know, literally within 2 days of this thing landing in our office, it gets sent over to the Attorney General's office, kind of whether they're ready for it or not. We're sending it over to them, and our hands are washed of it going forward.
Okay, final bit here. We're just a few months away from the midterms. So what are you and the commission focusing on between now and Election Day that you think voters should know?
Yeah, so this is it's our busiest time of year. We receive, you know, about 200 potential new cases every month during this, you know, busy election season. And so our staff is busy looking at, you know, what types of complaints have merit, which ones relate to the upcoming election. And then the first thing we try to do is we reach out to those folks and we try to gain compliance. If they need to file something, if they haven't done it properly, we try to work with them to get that information to the voters. Again, so that the voters have timely and accurate information before they cast their vote. That is the key mission of our agency and the Political Reform Act. And that's our first effort. Obviously, that doesn't always work. And so we have other tools, including we have the ability to go to court and get an injunction and require people and compel them to file those reports. We've done that in the past, and we continue to be ready to do that in the future when the circumstance arises.
Richard Matic, chair of California's Fair Political Practices Commission, thank you so much for your time today, and, you know, best of luck over the next couple of months.
Thanks, Randall. Pleasure being here.
Still ahead, it is a love letter to Sacramento, inspired by the diversity of the capital city. It's all told through food. We'll meet the creators and learn how they are reimagining ways to celebrate Sacramento cuisine. You're listening to Insight right here on Cap Radio. I'm your host, Randall White. We're back in just a moment.